James Edward Oglethorpe. James Oglethorpe was educated at a military school in England, and before he was 20, he joined the English army and fought in the Turkish War. When the Turkish War was over, he returned to England and settled down to ways of peace. His father and elder brothers died, and he inherited the family estates. He was now a very rich man, but he lived a simple and sober life. He was elected to Parliament and served as a member for many years. While he was in Parliament, an event occurred that turned his attention toward America and caused him to become the founder of Georgia. This is how it happened. There was a cruel law in England at that time by which a person in debt might be thrown into prison by his creditors and kept there until his debts were somehow paid. Many poor, unfortunate people, innocent of any crime, languished in these debtors' prisons. Oglethorpe had a dear friend, a Mr. Robert Castell, who was a scholar and an artist. He wrote a fine book on architecture, which he illustrated with splendid pictures drawn by his own hand. He was so much taken up with writing the book that he neglected his business affairs, and when the book was published, instead of making money for him, it brought him heavily in debt, and he was condemned to be cast into the debtor's prison. In the prison to which he was assigned, smallpox was at that time raging, and he had never had the disease. He begged the prison keeper, a heartless wretch by the name of Bambridge, to let him lie in the common jail until the prison should be freed of the smallpox, or until his friends could arrange to pay his debts for him, which he was sure would be done in the course of a few months. Bambridge agreed to do so if Castell would pay him down in cash a certain sum of money as a bribe. But poor Castell had not the money, so he was thrown into the smallpox-infested prison, where he soon contracted the disease, and after a few days' suffering, he died an awful death, leaving his wife and little children poverty-stricken and helpless. When Oglethorpe heard of this outrage, his blood boiled with indignation. He at once introduced a bill in Parliament to have a committee appointed to examine the prisons of England and bring about a reform in their management. The bill was passed. Oglethorpe was made chairman of the committee, and with the other members, he spent several months visiting the prisons. He found in them many practices of shocking cruelty, all of which were immediately abolished. If Oglethorpe had done nothing more than bring about this reform, he would deserve the lasting gratitude of humanity, but he did not stop at this. While visiting the prisons, his sympathies were deeply aroused for the poor debtors whom he found languishing behind iron bars, though innocent of any crime. He determined to try to do something to help them out of their sad condition. By his earnest appeals, he got Parliament to pass a law by which they might be set free, provided they would agree to go to America and establish there for England a new colony on a broad strip of unsettled country already claimed by her, south of the Savannah River. It lay next to Florida, which then belonged to Spain and had been colonized by her. The Spaniards were at that time one of the most powerful and warlike nations in the world, and in their hearts they were very hostile to the English, although not openly at war with them. The Spanish soldiers were bold, skillful, and heartless, so much so that someone said of them, "A Spanish soldier is a machine of steel with the devil inside of it." Fortunately for Oglethorpe's enterprise, King George II of England was anxious to plant colonies in his unoccupied possessions south of the Savannah River as a protection for South Carolina against the bold and unscrupulous Spaniards of Florida. So he gladly granted to Oglethorpe, for the use of debtors and other poor persons, all the country between the Savannah and the Altamaha rivers, and as far westward as they might choose to go. This strip of country was named Georgia, in honor of King George. A board of trustees, consisting of 36 members, among whom were some of the most distinguished men in England, was appointed by the king to have entire charge of planting, establishing, and governing the new colony. They were to serve without pay or compensation of any sort, it must be purely a labor of love with them. The good and great Lord Percival was president of the board, and Oglethorpe was one of the members. The trustees set about raising money to pay the cost of establishing the colony, for the poor people who were to go were not able to pay any part of their own expenses. Parliament made quite a liberal appropriation for the purpose, and a larger amount still was raised by public subscription from benevolent people in all parts of England. Altogether, the trustees soon had in hand $150,000, which was sufficient to establish a small colony. At one of the meetings of the trustees, it was suggested that some member of the board, a man of education and ability, should go over to America with the first colonists as their governor and live in Georgia with them until they were well and thoroughly established. Oglethorpe nobly volunteered to go, and the trustees were delighted. In undertaking this trying service, Oglethorpe would have to give up his luxurious home, the pleasures of refined society, and the splendid public career that was fast opening to him in England, and would have to endure untold hardships, privations, and dangers. And from it all, he had nothing in a worldly sense to gain for himself. The trustees had chosen as the official seal of the board a group of silkworms spinning their cocoons, and written underneath the noble motto, Non sibi sed alis, not for themselves, but for others. As those of you who have studied Latin know, the word sibi may also be correctly translated himself. The motto truly expressed the spirit of Oglethorpe in volunteering to go on this trying expedition. Non sibi sed alis, not for himself, but for others. He was at this time 43 years old and was yet unmarried. So far as we know, he had never had a sweetheart. Perhaps he was so busy that he had never had time to fall in love. When it was known that the great and good Oglethorpe himself would accompany the expedition, hundreds and hundreds of poor people, debtors and others, were anxious to go, but only a few could be taken. Out of the hundreds of applicants, the trustees carefully selected 40 strong, healthy men of good morals and with small families. Altogether, men, women, and children, the party consisted of 120 souls. Many poor wretches who begged to go had to be turned away with tears in their eyes and bitter disappointment in their hearts. The good ship Anne, a sailing vessel of 200 tons burden, was chartered to take the emigrants across the ocean to America. In her hold, as she lay moored to the wharf at Gravesend, were stored provisions and all kinds of tools and implements for the journey and for getting the colony well established in Georgia. Everything was then ready for the voyage. I will leave it to you to read of his years in Georgia, but we will pick up the story at the end, when he sailed away from Georgia. On the 23rd of July, 1743, James Oglethorpe left Georgia, never to return. As he was tossed on the waves of the Atlantic on his way back to his old home in England, what must have been his thoughts and feelings about the work in Georgia to which he had given 11 of the best years of his life? They had been years full of trial and tribulation to him. Of some of the hardships and dangers that he had to endure, you have learned in the foregoing pages, but these were the least of his troubles. In carrying out this great enterprise, he had to deal with many very mean people. He was constantly harassed, if so strong and firm a mind as his would allow itself to be harassed, by the dishonesty and treachery, the envy, hatred, malice, and all uncharitableness of persons who should have lent him a helping hand. Yet in coming to America to undertake this hard and trying work, Oglethorpe had made many sacrifices, for he gave up a luxurious home, the delights of literature, the pleasures of refined society, and a splendid public career that was just opening to him in England, and from it all he had absolutely nothing in a worldly sense to gain for himself. Non sibi sed alis. Tomochichi, that grand old savage, showed a spirit as unselfish and noble as Oglethorpe's. By the practice of a little business cunning, he might have obtained for himself rich rewards from the English for the great services that he rendered to them. but not one cent did he ever ask or receive. Even the presents that were made to him while he was in England, he gave away with a free hand to the poor people of his tribe on his return to America. He died at last in his humble wigwam, one of the poorest of men. In all that he did, he was governed by no other motive than to promote the best interest of his people. American history furnishes no finer illustration of pure and lofty patriotism. Non sibi, said Elise. The trustees of Georgia served without pay or reward of any kind. The work required much of their time and was full of grave responsibility. They looked after the affairs of the colony with as much care and diligence as if Georgia had been their private property and was being run as a money-making enterprise. And yet they well knew that, in a selfish sense, there was absolutely nothing in it, neither fame nor fortune for themselves. Non sibi, said Elise. Of all the American colonies, Georgia was certainly the one established on the noblest principles, and yet for a long time Georgia did not prosper. At the end of Oglethorpe's leaving, the whole enterprise seemed little better than a failure. Boundless enthusiasm, devoted self-sacrifice, strenuous work, and many hundreds of thousands of dollars had been expended on the undertaking. And yet, after 10 years, there were less than 3,000 people in the colony, and most of these were in a deplorable condition. Hundreds of people who had settled here moved away in disgust to the Carolinas and other more prosperous provinces. The reason generally given for this discouraging state of affairs is the obstinacy of Oglethorpe and the trustees in not allowing Negro slavery and the rum trade in Georgia. Another cause of the lack of prosperity was, no doubt, in the kind of people of whom the colony was largely composed. For, if the truth must be told, many of the emigrants who came to Georgia during Oglethorpe's rule were a sorry lot of folk, debtors, paupers, beggars, and all sorts of folk who had not been able to take care of themselves at home. Oglethorpe has been much blamed for peopling Georgia with such slipshod, knock-kneed human beings, but really it redounds to his glory that he was willing to extend a helping hand to these poor creatures whom no one else would help, and to give them one more chance in the world. True, as might have been expected, these persons made poor use of the opportunity, but Oglethorpe was not to blame for that. But Oglethorpe's work in Georgia was far from being the failure that it seemed. He had laid deep the foundation of splendid success. He had gained the lasting goodwill of the Indians. He had saved Georgia and Carolina, too, from Spanish conquest. In the face of dangers and obstacles that might have appalled the stoutest heart, he had planted a colony that was destined to grow into the great empire state of the South.